At the Denver station, Len McLean passed through the shoutings in omnibuses and came to the beginning of 17th Street, where is the first saloon. A customer was ordering hot scotch, and because Len liked the smell and had not thought of the mixture for a number of years, he took hot scotch. Coming then out upon the pavement, he looked across and saw a saloon opposite, with brighter globes and windows more prosperous. That should have been his choice, he allowed, and over he went at once. In such frozen weather, no drink could have been more timely, and he set to enjoy without haste its mellow fitness. Once again on the pavement, he looked along the street toward uptown, beneath the crisp, cold electric lights. It was a German place he had just quitted, and a huge light poured out on him from its windows, which the proprietor's fatherland sentiment had made into a show. Lights shone among a well-set pine forest, where beery, jovial gnomes sat on roots, and reached upward to Santa Claus. He held in his right hand forever a foaming glass. With his American back to this, the cowpuncher considered carefully which side of the road to take. Suddenly, three little bootblacks gathered where he stood and cried, "Shine! Shine!" The little one-note song reaching his attention, he suddenly shoved his foot at the nearest boy, who lightly sprang away. "Don't you dare touch him!" piped a snowbird dangerously. They were in short trousers, and the eldest, it may be, was 10. "Don't hit me," said Mr. McLean. "I'm innocent." "Well, you leave him be," said one. "What's he laying to kick you for, Billy? 'Tain't your pop, is it?" "No," said Billy in scorn. "Father never kicked me. Don't know who he is. He's a special officer, and he's going to arrest you. Dare you to arrest me?" said he. "Will you give me not to?" inquired Lynn. "Nothing. I've done nothing," announced Billy firmly. "Tell him you haven't been inside a store today. We can prove it."
"Say," said the slow-spoken Len from the pavement, "you're poor judges of an officer, you fellas. Why, I believe I'll get somebody else to black my boots for a dollar."
The three made a swift rush, fell on simultaneous knees, and clattering their boxes down, began to spit in an industrious circle.
"Easy, not having 3 feet," said the cowpuncher, always grave and slow. "I can only give 2 this here job."
"He's got a big pistol and a belt," exulted the leader.
"You're a smart boy," said Len, considering him, "and you find a man out right away. Now you stand off and tell me all about myself while they fix the boots. And a dollar goes to the quickest through."
Young Billy and his tow-headed competitor flattened down, each to a boot, with all their might, while the leader ruefully contemplated Mr. McLean.
"That's a Colt 45 you got," ventured he. "Right again. Some day maybe you'll be wearing one of your own, if the angels don't pull you before you're ripe."
"I'm through,"
sang out Towhead, rising in haste. Small Billy was struggling still, but leaped at it, the two heads bobbing to a level together, and Mr. McLean, looking down, saw that the arrangement had not been a good one for the boots.
"Will you kindly referee," said he to the leader, "and decide which of them smears is the awfulest?"
But the leader looked the other way and played upon a mouth organ.
"Well, I guess you've both won."
He handed each of them a dollar.
"Now I just doesn't show these boots uptown, so this time it's a dollar for the best shine."
The two went palpitating at their brushes again, and the leader played his mouth organ with brilliant unconcern. Through the bright plate glass, Santa Claus perpetually beamed. Billy was laboring gallantly, but the cowpuncher perceived Billy no seasoned expert.
"See here," said Len, stooping. "I'll show you how it's done. There. Keep your blacking soft and work with the dry brush."
"Let me," said Billy. "I've got to learn."
So he finished the boot his way, and this event was also adjudged a dead heat, with a resulting dollar to both parties. Their work was done, and more money in their pockets than from all the other boots and shoes of this day. Yet they delayed in the brightness of the window, drawn by curiosity near this new kind of man whose voice and remarks held them.
"You're a Wells and Fargo detective," asserted the leader.
"Play your harp," said Len.
"Are you a desperado?" whispered Towhead.
"Oh, my, What has our Jack been reading? He's a cattleman, cried Billy. I seen his heels. That's you. You'll do. But I bet you can't tell me what we cattlemen have sworn to do this night.
At this, they craned their necks and glared at him.
We are sworn to blow out 3 bootblacks to dinner.
Ah, pshaw! They backed away, bristling with distrust.
That's the old fellas. You may as well make your mind up, for I have to do it. Dare you to? Ah! And after dinner, it's the opera house to see the children of Captain Grant.
They screamed shrilly at him, keeping off beyond the curb.
I can't waste my time on such smart boys. I'm going somewhere to find boys that ain't so terrible quick, stampeded by a roast turkey.
He began to lounge slowly away, and they, stopping their noise short, swiftly picked up their boxes and followed him. Some change in the current of electricity that fed the window disturbed its sparkling light, so that Santa Claus, with his arms stretched out behind the departing cowpuncher, seemed to be smiling more broadly from the midst of his flickering brilliance. On their way to Turkey, the host and his guests exchanged but few remarks. The guests were too distracted to be capable of more than keeping after Mr. McLean in silence. They believed slimly in the turkey part of it, but what this man might do next kept their wits jumping deliciously, so when they saw him stop, they stopped instantly too, 10 feet out of reach. This was Denver's most civilized restaurant. Mr. McLean had never been inside it, but heard a tale from a friend, and now he caught a sudden sight of people among geraniums with plumes and white shirt fronts, very elegant.
Plum French! Shucks! They're eating patty de parlez-vous in there! Say, fellas, I wasn't raised good enough for them dude dishes. What do you say? I'm after a place where you can mention oyster stew without giving anybody a fit. What do you say, boys? Ah, you come along with us. We'll take you. We'll show you the boss place in Market Street.
So they clustered about him, and one pulled at his coat to start him. He started obediently and walked in their charge, they leading the way.
Christmas is coming now, sure, said Lynn, grinning to himself. It ain't exactly what I figured on.
It was the first time he had laughed since Cheyenne, and he brushed a hand over his eyes that were dim with the new warmth in his heart. Believing at length in him and his turkey, the alert street faces looked at him with ready intimacy as they went along in a friendly desire to make him acquainted with Denver. Only Billy, perhaps, now and then, stole at him a doubtful look. Presently, his 3 town mice introduced him to the place in Market Street. It was not boss, exactly, but the turkey and the oyster stew were there, with ketchup and vegetables in season and several choices of pie. Here the country mouse became again efficient, and to witness his liberal mastery of ordering and to imagine his pocket and its wealth renewed in the guests a transient awe. As they dined, however, this reticence evaporated, and they all grew fluent with oaths and opinions. At 1 or 2 words, indeed, Mr. McLean stared and had a slight sense of blushing.
"Have a cigarette?" said the leader over his pie. "Thank you," said Lynn. "I won't smoke if you'll excuse me." "Chewin's no good at meals. Don't you use tobacco?"
"Onct in a while."
The leader spat brightly.
"He ain't learned yet," said he,
slanting his elbows at Billy and sliding a match over his rump. He and Towhead soon left Billy behind and engaged in a town conversation that silenced him. Nor did Mr. McLean join in the talk, but sat embarrassed by their knowledge, which seemed about as much as he knew himself.
"I'll be goshed if I'd caught on to half that when I was streaking around in short pants. Maybe they grow up quicker now."
But now the country mouse perceived Billy's eager and attentive apprenticeship.
"Hello, boys. That theater's got a big start on us."
They had all forgotten he had said anything about the theater, and other topics left their impatient minds while the country mouse paid the bill and asked to be guided to the opera house. They were very late. The spectacle had advanced far into passages of the highest thrill, and Denver's eyes were riveted upon a ship and some icebergs. The party found its seats during several beautiful limelight effects and the remarkable fly buzzin' of violins, which is pronounced so helpful in times of peril and sentiment. The children of Captain Grant had been tracking their father all over the equator and other scenic spots, and now the North Pole was about to impale them. The captain's youngest child, perceiving a hummock rushing at them with a sudden motion, loudly shouted, "Sister, the ice is closing in!" And she replied chastely, "Then let us pray." It was a superb tableau. The ice split, and the sun rose and joggled at once to the zenith. The act drop fell, and male Denver, wrung to its religious deeps, went out to the rum shop. Of course, Mr. McLean and his party did not do this. The party had applauded exceedingly the defeat of the elements, and the leader, with Towhead, discussed the probable chances of the ship's getting farther south in the next act. Until lately, Billy's doubt of the cowpuncher had lingered, but during this intermission, whatever had been holding out in him seemed won, and his eyes shone the beginnings of hero worship.
"Don't you think this is splendid?"
"Splendid," Lynn replied, a trifle remotely.
"Don't you like it when they get all balled up and get out that way?"
"Hummin'," said Lynn.
"Don't you guess it's just girls, though, that do that?"
"What, young fella?"
"Why, all that prayer-saying stuff."
"I guess it must be.
She said to do it when the ice scared her, and of course a man had to do what she wanted him."
"Sure."
"Well, do you believe they'd have done it if she hadn't been on that boat and clung around and cried and everything and made her friends feel bad?"
"I hardly expect they would," replied the honest Lynn, and then suddenly mindful of Billy, "except there wasn't nothing else they could think of," he added, wishing to speak favorably of the custom.
"Why, that chunk of ice weren't so awful big anyhow, I'd have shoved her off with the pole, wouldn't you?"
"Butted her like a ram," exclaimed Mr. McLean.
"Well, I don't say my prayers any more. I told Mr. Perkins I wasn't a-going to, and I think he's a flub-dub anyway."
"I'll bet he is."
Lynn was scarcely a prudent guardian. "I told him straight, and he looked at me and down he flops on his knees, and he made them all flop. But I told him I didn't care for them putting up any camp meeting over me. And he says, 'I'll lick you.' And I said, 'Dare you to?' I told him mother kept a licking me for nothing, and I'd not pray for her, not in Sunday school or anywheres else. Do you pray much?"
"No."
"There, I told him a man didn't, and he said then a man went to hell." "You lie. Father ain't going to hell," I says, "and you ought to heard the first-class laugh right out loud. Girls and boys." And he was that mad. "But I didn't care. I came here with 50 cents.
"Ye must have felt like a millionaire."
I felt all right. I bought papers and sold them and got more and saved and got my box and blacking outfit. I weren't going to be licked by her just because she felt like it. And she feeling like it most any time. Let me see your pistol."
"You wait," said Lynn. "After this show is through, I'll put it on you."
"Will you, honest? Belt and everything? Did you ever shoot a bear?"
"Lord, lots."
"Honest? Silver tips?" "Silver tips. Cinnamon, black, and I roped a cub once't." "Oh, I never shot a bear."
"You ought to try it."
I'm a-going to camp out in the mountains. I'd like to see you when you camp. I'd like to camp with you. Mind I sometime?"
Billy had drawn nearer to Lynn and was looking up at him adoringly.
"You bet," said Lynn, and though he did not perhaps entirely mean this, it was with a curiously softened face that he began to look at Billy.
As with dogs and his horse, so always he played with what children he met. the few in his sagebrush world, but this was ceasing to be quite play for him, and his hand went to the boy's shoulder.
"Father took me camping with him once, the time Mother was off. Father gets awful drunk, too. I've quit Laramie for good."
Lynn sat up, and his hand gripped the boy.
"Laramie? Is your name Lusk?"
But the boy had shrunk from him instantly.
You're not going to take me home?"
"Heaven and heavens, so you're her kid."
He relaxed again, down in his chair, his legs stretched their straight length below the chair in front. He was waked from his bewilderment by a brushing under him, and there was young Billy diving for escape to the aisle. Len nipped that poor little attempt and had the limp Billy seated inside again. He had said not a word to the boy, and now watched his unhappy eyes seizing upon the various exits and dispositions of the theater. Nor could he imagine anything to tell him that should restore the perished confidence.
"Why'd you head him off?"
he asked himself unexpectedly, and found that he did not seem to know. But as he watched the restless and estranged runaway, he grew more and more sorrowful.
"I just hate him to think that of me."
The curtain rose, and he saw Billy make up his mind to wait until they should all be going out in the crowd.